So, as my title indicates, my talk is about neutrino physics. So I'm going to tell you about a few interesting recent experimental results in neutrino physics, and then mainly about theoretical interpretations of these results. In particular, I'm going to talk about the Minos experiment. What's happening to the pointer? I take the hockey stick, okay. So about the Minos experiment, which has seen an interesting difference between neutrino oscillations and anti-neutrino oscillations, which may or may not be a hint for CPT violation, either at the fundamental level or at some effective level. Fundamental level means basically introducing a CPT violating term in the Lagrangian by some way or another, and effective CPT violation is, for example, neutrino matter effects, where the neutrinos couple to the CPT asymmetric background matter in the Earth.
We can also violate
CPT and Lorentz invariants are connected, so. Oops. And in the second part of my talk, I'm going to talk about mini-boon and the reactor antineutrino anomaly and the so-called gallium anomaly, all of which by themselves are not very conclusive, but taken together, they may provide a hint for the existence of sterile neutrinos. Okay, so let me start by talking about the Minos results. But first, you may notice that my section headings all have question marks behind them, so maybe it's a good idea to start with Hinchcliffe's theorem, which says that when a title is in the form of a question, the answer is always no. So I hope that by the end of the talk, everybody will have his or her own opinion on the question. Okay, but for Minos. So Minos is a long baseline neutrino oscillation experiment where a neutrino beam is produced at Fermilab by pion decay in flight. So basically they dump a proton beam on a target to produce lots of pions. The pions are focused using a magnetic focusing horn. The pions then decay, and the resulting neutrino beam is then goes through the Earth up to Minnesota, where a detector is located in the Sudan mine. This is a picture of the detector. It's 735 kilometers away from the source. It's basically massive blocks of magnetized iron interleaved with a solid scintillator, so the iron is made is basically to provide a large target mass in which the neutrinos can interact, and the scintillator is then for track reconstruction. At Fermilab, they have a near detector, which is very similar to the far detector, just smaller, and the purpose of the near detector is to measure the unoscillated neutrino flux so that by taking ratios between far detector and near detector observations, one can cancel many of the systematic uncertainties associated with neutrino production and also with detection. Okay, this is what the Minos experiment has seen. On the left-hand side, I show results for muon neutrino oscillations. The red histogram is the neutrino energy spectrum one would expect if there were no neutrino oscillations. And as you can clearly see, the black data points are well below the no oscillation hypothesis. So there's a clear indication for neutrino oscillations. And in fact, the blue histogram here is the best fit of a two-flavor neutrino oscillation model. Then they've done a similar experiment in anti-neutrino mode. So they've basically just switched the polarity of the focusing system in their beam so that rather than producing mainly neutrinos, they now produce mainly anti-neutrinos. And again, they see a clear deficit compared to the no oscillation hypothesis. However, the oscillation parameters that give the best fit to the anti-neutrino data are different from the ones that give the best fit to the neutrino data. So if the oscillation, let's see, do I have this? No. So let's see the parameters on which the blue histogram here is based. If those were used also for anti-neutrinos, you would end up with the black histogram. And you see that this is somewhat high compared to the data. The error bars are still large, but it's still about a 2-sigma effect that the best oscillation fit would give a too high a rate in the anti-neutrino sector. This is more easily seen when you actually plot the allowed regions in the parameter space. So this is for a simple two-flavor oscillation model where the oscillation probability is just given by 1 minus sine squared twice a mixing angle times sine squared of the oscillation phase. So this term basically determines the amplitude of the oscillations, and this term determines the wavelength of the oscillations. And as you can see, there's about a 2-sigma discrepancy between the allowed region from the antineutrino data and the allowed region from the neutrino data. And here on the right-hand side, I just compare this to a fit that we have done ourselves, and I'm showing this plot only to convince you that we've carefully cross-checked the fitting code that we've been using, so we're actually able to reproduce their results, and so we have some confidence also in the new physics fits that I'm going to talk about later.
Yeah. Why the error ellipses are so different in size?
It's just less statistics in antineutrino mode. They didn't have as much running in antineutrino mode, and also antineutrino cross sections are smaller than neutrino cross sections, so it's harder to get to the same level of statistics. But they now already have more data, and I hope that later this year we should get an update on this.
Would it be reasonable to do a best fit from the joint test?
One can do this. Actually, I have this on one of my later slides. Let's see, maybe I can do a fast forward to that. Here, the pink histogram here is a joint fit. And as you can see, it's dominated by the neutrino data just because the neutrino data has much smaller error bars. And it's still not in as much agreement with the antineutrino data as one would wish.
Can you express this?
For the combined fit, I don't have the number ready. So I could, but I can't out of my memory.
So by two flavors, I assume you mean electron?
No, in this case, these are dominantly nu mu to nu tau oscillations.
Okay.
It's the same as for atmospheric neutrinos. There's maximal mix, or basically maximal mixing within errors between nu mu and nu tau. The super K ellipse would be about here. So super K has less precision on the delta M square, but they have a better precision on the mixing angle. So the super K ellipse would be somewhere around here, and it's more consistent with the Minos neutrino data than with the Minos antineutrino data. But again, since super K has large error bars, they cannot make a conclusive statement. They also cannot distinguish neutrinos from antineutrinos. So for them, it would be very hard to disentangle the two samples.
So what sort of runtime do they need for the antineutrino data to get as much data as the neutrino data?
They already have that data. I think it took them an additional year of running or so. Sorry. To get the same amount of data as in neutrino mode.
The error bars for the antineutrino would be about the same.
That would take several more years, and they are definitely not going to get that because the new Mi beam is going to be reconfigured to the NOVA configuration later this year or next year. So they have no chance of getting the same level of statistics, in my opinion.
The production cross sections of 5-1s are larger than the production cross sections of 5-1s. Yeah, I understand. The thing's built so they can just run it, right? So I'm just curious how they had it run.
Yeah. I don't know the exact number of years, but it's longer than they have. So, of course, since this is only a 2-sigma effect, there is certainly the possibility that this effect is just due to low statistics, and that with more statistics, the effect would just go away. So only time can tell. The other possibility is a systematic effect. I think there one just has to trust the experimentalists that they know what they are doing. And I know that they have done very careful cross-checks of their systematics. Nevertheless, there are several difficult parts in this analysis. For example, the extrapolation of the measured unoscillated neutrino spectrum at the near detector to the far detector is not as trivial as it might seem, because due to geometric effects, the near detector sees a slightly different spectrum than the far detector. So there could be something hidden in there. But I feel that I'm in no position to make a definitive statement on that. So theorists immediately after this result appeared said, oh, this might be CPT violation. So why CPT violation? Why not just CP violation? Well, the reason for this is that Minos is looking for new mu disappearance. So they start with muon neutrinos and they observe muon neutrinos. So this is a T invariant process. So by virtue of CPT, it must also be CP invariant. However, so this is why people dismissed the possibility of just CP violation. However, as I'm going to tell you later, there is still the possibility that there are new contributions to neutrino interactions and that those are just CP violating.
But how can you violate CP? I mean, it just follows during upper page from unitarity.
That's one of the reasons why I'm not a big fan of CPT violation. I'm going to talk about this on this slide and the next one. One thing you can do is you can defer the question of where it comes from to later and just do phenomenology. So what people have done is they have just used phenomenological parameterizations. For example, you can just assume that the mixing matrices and the masses for neutrinos and antineutrinos are completely independent, and then you do separate fits to the global neutrino data and to the global antineutrino data. Or you can introduce just explicit Lorentz and CPT violating operators in the Lagrangian. For example, an operator like this one where you have a vector current coupled to just a constant four vector. But even though this is possible on a phenomenological level, I think there are deep questions to ask of what does this mean for quantum field theory.
Well, you also have to fine-tune it for electrons, right? Because the neutrinos and electrons come together, the corresponding term will be excluded electrons that are high.
Yes, right. But once you violate CPT, you can also violate SU2.
Violate CPT.
I fully agree. This is.
It's not as funny because you also have radiated interactions. So once you start putting big things in the neutrino sector, are they precipitating in the electron sector?
I fully agree. One thing you can do to affect only neutrino masses and not charged lepton masses is to do something to the right-handed neutrinos.
True.
If you have something like
true.
A seesaw mechanism.
And this right-handed neutrino has to be light. If it's heavy, it's still violated by one double. I had a paper on that back in when we came up this. Not 0.9, but it was probably 0.9 something. When it it's very constraining the electron thing.
That is certainly
unless your right-handed neutrino is very light and your color coupling is very small.
Well, if the right-handed neutrino is heavy, like seesaw is heavy.
Then your color coupling is order one, and then any heat exchange after that, or double exchange is actually mix operators between neutrino and electron.
But I mean, the right-handed neutrino in that case would be maybe 10 to the 12 or 10 to the 13
right.
GeV.
That's
so
you have a logarithmic sensitivity. It's not
decoupling,
it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
There's a paper by Wally Greenberg. Maryland University 2002, claiming to prove that if you have CPT violation, you must have Lorentz violation. A dispute has broken out recently about this.
I'm not familiar with the dispute, but I'm familiar with the claim.
Okay. So the dispute is that if you have a non-local quantum field theory, then
it
no longer follows.
Mm-hmm.
Then another paper came out from Wally Greenberg 3 weeks ago. Claiming that he's only working with local quantum field theory because the time order product is not well defined in the non-local quantum field theory, which I disagree with. I'm emailing him about this. Anyway.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see what comes out of this. So, as I said, most of the CPT violating papers on Minos are purely phenomenological. There is one paper that makes an attempt to go a little further. By those folks from the IPMU in Tokyo, where they actually do introduce CPT violation in the right-handed neutrinos and then mediate it to the left-handed ones. So they assume we're living in a world with extra dimensions. They have on some distant brain in five dimensions. They postulate that there is some kind of ghost field that forms this type of condensate. They don't specify the mechanism by which this can happen. But I know that there are papers that propose mechanisms to do this, but I'm not too familiar with those papers. So what these guys do is they just postulate that the time derivative of a ghost-like scalar field acquires a VAV. Then they introduce couplings between that ghost field and right-handed neutrinos, which are propagating in the bulk. So that way, you get a Lorentz and CPT violating right-handed neutrino bilinear term. And then since right-handed neutrinos do propagate in the bulk, they mediate this CPT violation to our 4D brain, on which in their model the standard model is localized. I'm actually not sure about that. I think they can't be too heavy because they explain the lightness of the neutrino masses by how they localize the right-handed neutrinos in the extra dimension.
CPT are discrete symmetries.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing a Higgs type thing like this.
You just have a preferred direction after the condensation.
Lorentzian lines is violated. But also, how do they motivate the ghost field unless it's wrong?
They don't really model the ghost field. They just postulate that it is there and that it gets this
way. Why does it need to be a ghost?
I think they want it to be coupled only through derivatives. I think ghost just means its kinetic term has the wrong sign.
Okay, so that's bad.
No, they have a quartic term, the kinetic quartic term, minus the wrong sign, the quadratic term, and that's...
It actually follows from old Landau work in studies done to classify all the possible crystals.
Could be any d larger than 4. I think they want to have this far away from the standard model, so they don't want it to happen on our brain. I think if you try to introduce a field like that on our brain, then it might be hard to forbid other harmful couplings to the standard model particles. I mean, you want this to do something only to right-handed neutrinos, because right-handed neutrinos then mediated only to neutrinos. So you are, let's say, effects in the charged lepton or a charged fermion section, the standard model, would only appear at higher loop orders. So
at one loop order, and everything depends on what the Yukawa coupling is. If Yukawa coupling is all large-ish, wide indices, then it's as bad as...
So this paper doesn't go into detail on any of these precision constraints that you are referring to. So there's certainly a possibility that this is already ruled out by something that we might have overlooked. Okay, now something a little more down to earth. We know that there is CPT violation in neutrino oscillations, and it's usually called the neutrino metapotential. When neutrinos propagate just through ordinary matter, then they of course couple to it through W and Z exchange. And since the matter in the Earth consists only of particles, not of antiparticles, the potential that neutrinos feel because of that is different for neutrinos and antineutrinos. It has this form, square root 2 times the Fermi constant times the electron density, and it just changes sign when you go from neutrinos to antineutrinos. So, let's see. This is true in the standard model. We know it's very important for solar neutrinos. It's a well-established effect. However, it's far too small to explain the Minos anomaly. The reason is that this potential affects only electron neutrinos, so it does not affect the mu to tau sector to which Minos is most sensitive, and any effects that might spill over from the electron sector into the mu tau sector are suppressed either by a small mixing angle or by the small ratio of the two mass squared differences. So it's clear that standard matter effects are not enough to explain Minos. So one can go one step further and ask the question, is there a possibility that there are no non-standard contributions to this potential? Again, I'm first going to talk about this on an effective theory level, and then I'm going to address the question on how this can be done or whether this can be done in renormalizable models.
So the ratio of this effect to the actual measured effect is 10 to the minus what?
Let me think, it's 10 to the minus few. It's not like that you're 20 orders of magnitude off, but you're a few orders of magnitude off.
Okay.
Maybe 3 or 4 would be my rough guesstimate. Several people have considered non-standard matter effects in relation to the Minos experiment. However, they were mostly focusing on the Minos search for electron neutrino appearance. So this is not really relevant to the...
There was a paper by Ann Nelson,
right, but Ann Nelson in her models, to my knowledge, also has sterile neutrinos, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So what I'm going to do is I'm only going to introduce new terms in this potential. So on the Lagrangian level, I'm just going to introduce an effective 4-fermion coupling between neutrinos, possibly of different flavors, and some standard model fermions, in particular, electrons up, quarks, and down quarks. So this is wrong. This should be electron up and down. It has to be a fermion that actually exists in the background matter.
So I know you're going to talk about it, but neutrinos exist together with and with leptons.
That's actually...
If I just naively stick a contact interaction like that, none of that will survive probably teletron constraints and...
That is actually true. And when I said I'm going to talk about ways of embedding this into renormalizable models, that's exactly the problem that I will run into. So I'm going to come to that in a few slides.
Left bounds,
flavor changing processes in the charged lepton sector, like mu to e gamma, there's lots of constraints.
You can avoid it though by making light mediators, right? As we know,
you can do everything.
Like, with light mediators, you have some wiggle room.
Yeah, that's also one of the comments I was going to make later. So on a purely phenomenological level, we can just introduce additional terms in this potential. So in the standard model, there is just a 1 in the electron-electron term and zeros everywhere else. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to introduce diagonal terms in the mu and tau sector and also an off-diagonal term. I can then compute the neutrino oscillation probability by just taking the initial neutrino state, time evolving it, projecting onto the final neutrino state, and taking the squared modulus. And the Hamiltonian I'm using for the time evolution is just a kinetic term proportional to the neutrino energy for the different mass eigenstates plus this now non-standard matter potential. And remember, when I go from neutrinos to antineutrinos, that potential changes sign.
Just even at the naive level. So if I take the one that has epsilon e mu, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I dress this one by 1W, wouldn't I get like actual muon to electron on quarks or operator that's probably, you know, killed by orders of allowing for a general radiative correction is probably killed by mu to
actually, there are papers that are deriving constraints on these parameters precisely from things like mu to e gamma. And they come to the conclusion that mu to e gamma alone, if you don't impose SU2 invariance, is not a strong constraint, at least not in a model-independent way. Once you go to a concrete model, it's typically a very strong constraint. But in a model-independent way, they usually don't get large results. And this has, let me think if I can remember what the argument was. Yeah, I can look it up. We can talk about it later. Also mutually conversion, yeah, all those one-loop induced processes, those have been considered, and they set some limit, but it's not a terribly strong limit. So if we do this...
But you're saying if you impose a suit between invariants, then it is very
strong. Then it is very strong. So what you would have to do if you want SU2 invariants and this operator, you would have to find a way to create a dimension 8 operator, which involves two neutrinos, two standard model fermions, and two Higgs fields. And then when the Higgs gets a VAF, it can project out the neutrino component from the SU2 doublets.
You'll be struggling with naturals because you can still figure it out against.
And you will also be struggling with the fact that, of course, a dimension 8 operator is suppressed by two additional powers of a high scale. So I'm by no means trying to say that this is the solution. In fact, in the end, I'm going to say that this is not the solution for precisely the reasons that you guys are already pointing out. In the meantime, if this operator was there, looking at the blue dotted lines here, it can reconcile the Minos neutrino data and the Minos antineutrino data, so I get a fair fit to both spectra. And then when I look at it when I look at the allowed regions in the new physics parameter space, I get these plots. So the way these are to be interpreted is I'm looking at a three-dimensional parameter space. I have a parameter epsilon tau tau, which is real, and I have epsilon mu tau, which has a modulus and a phase. I can neglect epsilon mu mu because to lowest order, Minos is only sensitive to the difference of the two, so I need to keep only one of them. So I have those three parameters. And the three panels I'm showing here are basically projections of this three-dimensional parameter space onto the faces of a cube. So you see that there are allowed regions. They are for non-zero parameter values, obviously. And you also see that there are some existing constraints that I have plotted here. The most model-independent constraints are the ones shown in gray here, here, and here. And you see that those, at least in a model-independent way, they do not impose a constraint. Again, when I go to a concrete model, the constraints will become stronger. However, I don't even need to do this because there's atmospheric neutrinos. And atmospheric neutrinos are very sensitive to effects of that type because, as I explained, this is basically a neutrino matter effect. And atmospheric neutrinos are going through a lot of matter on their way to the detector. So the constraint from atmospheric neutrinos is actually here, here, and here. So you see that there is a significant amount of tension there. Actually, the tension between this and the atmospheric neutrinos is about as big as the tension between Minos neutrino and antineutrino data that we started with in the very beginning. Now, one could argue that the atmospheric neutrino bounds I've shown here were derived in a two-flavor framework and may not be entirely robust, but people have given very good arguments why they are robust and why they can, by at least the important ones, extend also to the three-flavor case. So my conclusion is that this scenario, even without making any model-building arguments, it's already ruled out by data. Okay, let me skip this.
Can I
ask a
question? Sure. You're saying non-standard.
It's a terrible word, I know.
Non-standard model. It's a full Fermi interaction. So if you're an energy well below the topic of the Z mass, should be fine. What are the energies involved?
Basically, the process I'm interested here in is coherent forward scattering of neutrinos on electrons or standard model particles. This is basically a process with zero momentum transfer.
Yeah.
So the effective theory approach is always valid.
Yes.
However, we have done experiments at higher energies, so as a model builder, one has to worry about how will this effective operator be embedded into a full theory. And then when I look at the required magnitude of the effects here, this is like maybe half as strong as standard model weak interactions. So the scale that's suppressing these operators cannot be terribly high. It should be well within the reach of at least the LHC, maybe even LEP or the Tevatron. So I have to worry about the question of how I embed these operators into renormalized.
As far as this analysis is concerned, dealing with low energy between the traction.
As far as this analysis is concerned, effective theory is always a good thing to do.
The theoretical part of our renormalization is still a question mark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. For the phenomenological analysis.
Direct constraints. If you just say neutrinos are part of the left-handed double, you don't dispute that, right? I mean, you put that in, and much of these operators are going out of the door, right? Just because of the strong constraints on whatever.
He's saying you don't even have to do that.
Like these constraints are strong enough.
Atmospheric neutrinos are pro.
I'm trying to argue once you start making it thermal light.
I'll make a big deal of it.
In those panels, the constraints and the fits are just, they don't depend at all on Q squared. So even if I did introduce the light mediator, it wouldn't matter because you're just considering the forward scattering.
Let's see. I believe that some constraints, especially the ones shown in dark gray here, they do depend on Q squared. For example, Charm and Newtep are both experiments operating somewhere in the GeV region. But the atmospheric constraint does not depend on any of this. It's described by exactly the same effective field theory as Minos. Okay, now remember that I said in the beginning, nu mu to nu mu is a. Has to preserve CP, so we can never explain this using CP violation. However, what Minos is actually looking at is not nu mu to nu mu oscillations. What they know is that they have produced a pion, and that in the end they detect a muon. And what happens in between, who knows? So one could argue that maybe the neutrino production or the neutrino detection process gets modified. And since this is no longer a CP invariant transition, I could, in principle, have CP violating effects in there. Now, one can play this game. One can argue that either there has to be a modified nu mu flux that produces an anomalous suppression or increase in the muon rate. That if this is the case, it should be there only at the far detector, but not at the near detector, because the near detector is used for cross-calibration. So one could ask, for example, could there be a new tau contamination in the NUMI beam? This would be new taus would not be seen by the near detector, and then on the way to the far detector, they would oscillate into new mu. However, this is ruled out because people have looked for new taus in a pion decay beam. Another possibility is an interaction where a new tau produces a muon in an anomalous way. Again, at the effective theory level, this can be written like this. Fermi constant times some new effective coupling constant times up quark, down quark, muon, and tau neutrino. And this coupling constant can be complex, so we can have CP violation now. Again, at the effective theory level suitable to Minos, you can do a fit. It's the solid blue line here. Again, you get a good agreement with the spectrum. You can look at the allowed regions. You can compare to the model-independent constraints that we have. And in this case, you find agreement. So again, with an interaction like 10 times weaker than the standard model weak interaction, so all this epsilon is always relative to the strength of the standard model interactions. Say an interaction 10 times weaker is perfectly fine and can explain Minos. However, from a model builder's point of view, this is still very problematic because it's a charged current interaction. So in order to mediate this interaction by a single new particle, you need this new particle to be charged. And since still 10 times weaker than the standard model weak interactions is still pretty strong, so this new charged particle cannot be too heavy. And about 0.1. So epsilon, I parameterize the coupling constant as G Fermi times epsilon. So if epsilon is 0.1, this means the new interaction is 10 times weaker than standard model weak interactions.
Right. What's the mass of the charged particle?
Well, of course, it depends to some degree also on how the charged particle couples. But if you assume that the renormalizable couplings of the charged particle are the same as standard model weak interactions, then then it should be like a factor of 3 heavier than the Z.
Then it won't be strongly constrained by electron muon pair universality in the 5+.
Actually, we are assuming a vector interaction so that it does not contribute to pion decay. That's a crucial point I skipped over, because if it contributed to pion decay, again the search for new mu for new tau in a pion beam would rule it out.
So this is a new source of CV violation beyond standard model.
Yes.
So how does it compare roughly to the size of CV violations in the
standard model? You need maximal CP violation ideally. So here, the vertical axis is the CP violating phase, and the horizontal axis is the modulus of the coupling. So you see that if you want to push the modulus of the coupling as small as possible, you're either here at 90 degrees or here at 270 degrees. You could also live with a weaker CP violation, but in that case, you would need a much larger coupling constant, and that makes even more trouble for model building. Okay, so let me briefly come to the question of how can non-standard neutrino interactions arise from heavy new physics. As we have already discussed today, it's very hard to get it. In particular, we have to worry about SU2 invariance, obviously. So whatever you do to the neutrino sector will also happen to charged leptons, and there are many constraints from the charged lepton sector. One way out is to introduce dimension 8 operators. And there are two groups who have played this game, Antosh Baumann, Fernandez-Martinez, and Gavila, Hernandez, Ota, and Winter. And they come to the conclusion that it's really a pain to get these dimension 8 operators to induce large non-standard neutrino interactions without at the same time also inducing problematic dimension 6 effects. So they basically need arbitrary cancellations between several of their coupling constants. They need several new particles. It's really becoming an ugly model. So it's not completely impossible, but it looks very unnatural to when you just look at the Lagrangians and the particle content.
Would you say that the more natural direction would be to introduce another light species of neutrino and play with the interaction of
more? Yes. Yeah, many constraints on non-standard interactions come from high-energy processes. So if the particles that mediate the new interactions are very light, these interactions will be suppressed in the high-energy processes. For example, here I show a plot from where did the reference go? Here, no. So this is from a paper by Bjork and Essig et al. The scenario they consider here is a light Z prime type particle kinetically mixed with the standard model. And you can see that for masses of around 10 to 100 GeV, you can live with relatively large kinetic mixing parameters, like larger than order 10 to the minus 3. So there's a window of opportunity for light new physics here. And of course, this could also do something to the neutrino sector. Let me also point out that light new physics has also been interesting for different reasons. For example, if you're talking about Sommerfeld-enhanced dark matter models, or as Maxime and Joseph are doing, when you talk about explaining the Dharma and cogent signals using anomalous neutrino interactions. And again, the advantage of light new physics is that the processes we are looking at when talking about neutrino matter effects are basically zero momentum transfer, whereas the constraining processes are at higher energy. So those processes are only suppressed by 1 over the light mediator mass to the fourth power, whereas squared. Whereas the higher energy processes are suppressed by 1 over Q squared, where Q squared is now in the GeV region. So you can get an extra suppression in the high energy constraints compared to the light operators, compared to the light processes in neutrino physics.
Is this model, I'm sorry,
yeah.
Just, this
plastics, then what happens if you impose the new Xenon 100 constraints?
That depends, and actually, I think it's an interesting question to ask.
Fine. Why is that?
Because that will help. I mean, you have a recoil on Xenon. Xenon is very heavy, so even cross backing will be cut off very strictly from
it. So, what I would to ask this Nelson model, it's a gauge beam on a cell, right? Somewhat lighter mediator, but overall strength of the interaction is stronger than the Luke force, if I remember it correctly.
But again, if I remember those models correctly, they have, again, sterile neutrinos. So.
That's correct, yeah, yeah. No, but what I was just wondering if it's at all consistent with solar neutrino, and they arrive in all three different flavors, you know. We know they're roughly their interaction with electrons, right? You cannot modify it by much. I was just concerned that those models would be possibly ruled out by just the boric xenon.
If I remember those models correctly, what they are doing is they are introducing three additional sterile neutrinos.
Right.
So they have oscillations between the whole active neutrino sector and the whole sterile neutrino sector.
But the key is that you still need a large matter effects, right? And this B minus L interaction is by any means not, it's fairly sizable, right?
I'm not sure if these models are consistent with solar neutrinos. I would guess that they have thought about it, but I'm not sure. Okay, let me come to the second part of my talk about Miniboon, the reactor antineutrino anomaly, and hints for sterile neutrinos. First, let me tell you what the reactor antineutrino anomaly is. It's based on a recent paper by Müller et al., where they have just re-evaluated, or I shouldn't say just because it's a very involved calculation, they have re-evaluated the expected antineutrino flux from a nuclear reactor. The way this is done is there is data on electron spectra from uranium fission, from plutonium fission. And so you look at this electron spectrum and then try to convert it into a neutrino spectrum. Of course, if you have just a single beta decay, this is easy. Because there's the neutrino energy and the electron energy have to add up to the total Q value of the decay. However, the beta spectrum you get from a nuclear reactor is composed of many, many different beta decays, and not all of them are well understood because some of the isotopes that you produce are extremely short-lived, so they cannot be studied in the laboratory. One doesn't have the full information about all the beta decays that are contributing, and this makes that conversion difficult. In an old calculation that has been used by basically every reactor neutrino experiment done so far, the author has just used 30 effective branches. So they just assumed there are 30 beta decays that are contributing to this spectrum, and the relative contribution of each individual beta decay and the Q value of each individual beta decay was just taken to be free parameters. The new method that has been used by Müller et al. Is much more involved. They make full use of the nuclear databases. So all the isotopes that have been studied in the lab, they use this information. And that way, they are already able to account for 90% of the antineutrino flux using well-understood data. And only for the remaining 10%, they use this effective branches fitting procedure. And you may ask the question, why 5? So they checked using more branches, but it didn't change their results, so they settled for 5 in the end. They also include careful error propagation. They use correlation matrices between different measurements. They do a careful job dealing with systematic uncertainties. They take into account off-equilibrium corrections, which means that the samples from which those beta spectra are coming were only irradiated for a relatively short amount of time. So not all the different beta branches were already equilibrated, and they correct for this. So it's a much more careful analysis than the old one. And they did one important cross-check that convinced me that this is to be taken serious. Namely, they made a simulation. using a few well-known beta branches, so just a few well-known isotopes that are well understood in the table of isotopes, they simulated the quote-unquote true electron spectrum. So they produced bogus data of this type. Then, using their method, they reconstruct the new EBAR spectrum, and they do the same using the old method. And when they use the old method, they get a result that's about 3% off. So this shows that there is actually something subtly wrong with the old method, and that maybe their new result is actually true. And I should say what the new result is. So of course that the expected reactor antineutrino flux is 3.5% higher than what people had previously thought. So what if this is confirmed, and I know that several groups are now trying to redo this calculation and confirm or refute this claim, but if it is true, what it means is that all the reactor experiments that have been done so far have observed a deficit of neutrinos. That's shown in this plot as a function of the distance from the reactor, the normalized neutrino flux. So for the old, according to the new computation of the neutrino fluxes, you would expect the points to be scattered around the red line up here, but actually they are scattered around the blue line down there. So this is, again, I think that's about a 2-point-something sigma effect, if I remember the number correctly.
Just eyeballing that thing gives me a headache.
I can switch to a different slide.
Why do the lines come
together? Oh, this is, I think this is basically a fit that tries to give the best agreement with the data. And for the red line, they have just assumed a non-zero value of theta 1.3, which starts leading to standard model suppression of the oscillations at some distance.
It will be still in the non-sigma error bar.
Yeah. So another way of showing this is by plotting the effective mixing angle. So if we hypothesize that this disappearance is due to neutrino oscillations into some, say, a sterile neutrino state, then we can plot the allowed reach or the preferred region in the plane of the effective mixing angle versus the mass squared difference between the active neutrinos and the sterile one. And you can see that for the if the old computation of neutrino fluxes was right, you would just get the blue exclusion curves here. And if the new computation is right, you get at 90% confidence level, you get a closed allowed region. And then at higher confidence level, it's still consistent with zero. So again, this is not a terribly conclusive effect, but it's an interesting hint. And there are others. So there is the long-standing LSND anomaly, which has recently become more interesting again when Miniboon results appeared. So what LSND had, they had a new mu bar beam from a stopped pion source, and in that beam they looked for electron antineutrino appearance. This is the data they got. The green and red histograms are the expected backgrounds, and the black dots are the actual data that they observed. So you can see that there is a clear excess over background, and the significance of that is above 3 sigma.
How well do you know the background? Errors in this fluke or whatever?
It's, of course, a valid question to ask. But to my knowledge, the LSND data has been analyzed and reanalyzed by different people, and no one could come up with a convincing explanation for why the background prediction should be wrong. Also, a stopped pion source is a relatively well-understood source, so it's relatively easy to reliably compute the spectrum of neutrinos that you expect. But of course, there are always systematic effects. For example, some of the pions will decay before they are stopped. Some of them or will actually interact in some other component of the setup, like in the walls or in some other material. And all these are contributions that have to be taken into account. So it's certainly a valid question to ask. Miniboon has done a similar but not identical experiment. They did not use a stopped pion source, but they actually have a neutrino beam from pion decay in flight. And they can choose the polarity. So they can do this experiment in neutrinos or in antineutrinos. And also they are doing it at significantly higher energy, about an order of magnitude higher. And this is the Minibun antineutrino data. Again, the colored histograms are the expectation, and the dots are the with error bars are the data. And there is a not quite significant, but I think like 2 sigma-ish or so excess around here. And this by itself would not be very intriguing, but it's perfectly consistent with what LSND is seeing. However, additional complication, Minibun has done the same thing in neutrino mode, looking at neutrinos rather than antineutrinos, and they don't see any excess in the interesting region. They see an excess at lower energy, which people have not too many good ideas where it's coming from, but Minibun is only considering the region above 475 GeV because they say that's where they trust their data most. And in that region, which would be relevant for LSND, they don't see an excess in neutrino mode.
So this second data point here in the antineutrino data is not trustworthy then, which is high, which looks high. It's below the...
Yeah, usually in their main money plots, they set a threshold at 475. They have this data, and I think even their original idea was to use all the data from 200 GeV, from 200 MeV up, but they just say the lower the energy, the harder it is to predict the backgrounds. So it's more likely that there's something wrong in the left hand side of this line than at the right hand side. But
they just have a generic problem at low energies in both of those spectra, except for one point, which is the third point on the antineutrino. That's could be a downward fluctuation.
Yeah.
This is like generically that you just can't trust it below
0.5.
That's what the line is.
Yeah.
But I mean, so, that means it'd be 0.6. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the main criticisms that the Minibun collaboration usually receives. Since all their background predictions are based on simulations, they have no very good way of proving that their modeling of backgrounds is correct. So what they would need in principle is, like Minos, they would need a near detector. They would need a second detector that is closer to the neutrino source. Actually, the reason why it's called Minibun is because they don't have the near detector. The original proposal was to have a near and a far detector, but they only got one detector. So they are now thinking about building an additional detector closer to the source, but I don't know what's going to become of that. So at the moment, we have to live with the results we have. So there is this tension between neutrinos and antineutrinos, and there is also the tension between those experiments and an experiment called Carmen, which was very similar to LSND but did not observe an excess. Again, interpreting all this mass in terms of sterile neutrinos, what I'm plotting here is the effective mixing angle of these nu mu to nu e oscillations versus the mass squared difference between the active and the sterile neutrinos. The colored region here is what is the parameters you need if you want to explain LSND and the Minibun antineutrino data. The blue line is the constraint coming from the non-observation of an excess in Minibun neutrino mode, in the Carmen experiment, and in the NOMAD experiment, which was also a short baseline experiment looking for electron neutrino appearance. So you see it's ruling out a large part of the allowed region, but not all of it. However, that allowed region is then ruled out by disappearance searches. These are, on the one hand, the reactor experiments searching for electron disappearance, and on the other hand, experiments like a device called CDHS at CERN, which looked for mu mu disappearance. So the idea is this appearance. Do we have chalk anywhere? It's not terribly important. The idea is, since LSND and Minibun had been looking at oscillations between muon neutrinos and electron neutrinos, in order to get an excess in that mode from a sterile neutrino, the oscillations would basically have to proceed through a sterile state. So you have a mixing between the muon neutrino and the sterile neutrino, and a mixing between the electron neutrino and the sterile neutrino. And in that case, the actual this effective mixing angle would be proportional to mu 4 squared times ue 4 square, where those two quantities are elements of the neutrino mixing matrix, mixing muon neutrinos with the sterile state and mixing electron neutrinos with the sterile state. And the product of these is proportional to this, to sine squared, this effective mixing angle. So you can see if the effective mixing angle is of order 10 to the minus 2, then each of those ones has to be maybe of order 0.1 or so. So it should be much easier to see an effect that is maybe just suppressed by u mu 4 square. And such an effect would be muon neutrino disappearance in a new mu beam. So you produce new mu, and you just count how many of them you get at the detector. So the idea was that it should be much easier to see such an effect in a disappearance experiment. And that's where the green constraint here is coming from. And again, but again, you see it's basically ruling out the LSND and mini-boon region. So in a simple scheme with just one extra sterile neutrino, this does not work very well. And the main reason for this is, since there is no CP violation in such a scheme, because it can be effectively described as a two-flavor problem, since there is no CP violation, it's impossible to reconcile the LSND and mini-boon antineutrino results with the mini-boon neutrino result. There is this tiny region here, but I mean, this is an overlap of the two 99% confidence level regions. So if you were in that sweet spot, the total probability, statistical probability for that to be true would already be pretty low. One is for the old reactor neutrino fluxes, the other one is for the new fluxes. The solid one.
The old and new calculation?
Yes. The solid one is for the new calculation. So you see it makes things a little better, but not terrible. Another anomaly I would briefly like to mention is the so-called gallium anomaly. This comes from the Galax and Sage experiments. These were both solar neutrino detectors. And they did calibration measurements using a very intense radioactive source that they brought in close to the detector. And so since they knew the activity of the source, they knew the number of neutrinos that was produced in there, and they also observed a deficit compared to the prediction. So on my last slides, I'm going to show you the results of a global fit to all relevant neutrino data, which we performed a few months ago. We include atmospheric neutrinos, we include the reactor experiments, we include several of the short baseline experiments. We do not include the gallium anomaly for the moment because that's like the weakest hint we have. And even though I'm not going to have it in the plot by now, we also checked the inclusion of MINOS, and the result is it does not change anything qualitatively. We checked that all our codes are reproducing the individual fits from the respective experiments, so we have confidence that what we are doing is right.
So, sorry, can I ask you, in the gallium experiment, the source, is it in situ? So it would instantaneous?
Yeah, I know how it worked in Galax. I'm not sure about Sage. So Galax basically had this, to my knowledge, had this tube in the middle of the detector in which they could insert the source so that it would be right in the middle of the detector. We did a fit in a 3 plus 1 neutrino scheme and in a 3 plus 2 neutrino scheme. And this is what we find. What I'm showing here is the delta m squared of the first sterile neutrino mass eigenstate compared to the active neutrinos, and this is the delta m squared of the second sterile state compared to the active neutrinos. And you see that you get the best agreement between the data and the prediction. If one of the neutrinos is maybe 0.5 eV square away, and the second one is about 0.9 eV square away. Here I also show how the chi-square of the fit depends on one of the two delta M squares. And again, solid lines are for the new reactor fluxes, dashed lines are for the old reactor fluxes. So you see that going from the old to the new reactor fluxes, you get an improvement of a few units in chi-square. And also going from a 3 plus 1 scheme to a 3 plus 2 scheme, you get a relatively large improvement in chi-square. I should also mention the total number of degrees of freedom in this fit is about 140. I think it was 137 or so. So the goodness of fit looks okay from this plot. And the lower plot here is just the reactor data, and this is all data. So this, the upper one is the more interesting one. However, what we also did is we did a so-called parameter goodness of fit test, where we test, this is a statistical test to compare the compatibility of two data sets by comparing the global minimum chi-square from a combined fit to the individual chi-squares when you do separate fits to one data set and to the other data set. And we did this comparing the LSND and Miniboon results to the other experiments, so the experiments that have a signal compared to those that don't have a signal for stereoneutrinos. And we did this for appearance versus disappearance measurements. And you can see that even with the new reactor neutrino fluxes, the p-value associated with this parameter goodness of fit test is still pretty low. So it's below 1% in both cases. So this means there is still some tension in the fit, even in the 3+2 case. So even adding two sterile neutrinos does not remove all the tension from the global fit. And of course, what is not mentioned here at all is that having two extra neutrinos at masses of order 1 electron volt is, of course, a challenge for cosmology. Because,
can I ask you, is this bound, is it mixing angle dependent?
Which bound?
I mean, this is
all marginalized over all parameters that are not shown.
The cosmology, I presume you refer to the structure constraints. How does it work? I mean, you assume initially that these are not populated, right? And then you populate them through oscillations, right?
Then
you'd be also given, sensitive to the mixing angle, right?
Well, I think in standard cosmology, they would be populated from the very beginning, because when you look at the Lagrangian of the weak charged current interaction, you have a W coupling to a charged lepton and a neutrino, say the W couples to all neutrino mass eigenstates with a coupling constant proportional to the mixing matrix element.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. So they would be sensitive to how many, what the size of the mixing
angle is. But unless the mixing angle is extremely tiny, this interaction should always be strong enough to populate them thermally in the beginning. Maybe the sterile neutrinos would decouple a little earlier than the active ones because they have weaker mixing. But in general, without doing anything fancy to cosmology, I would expect all of them to be populated equally.
No, that doesn't sound right.
I mean, by order of magnitude.
No, that doesn't sound right. Mm. The W couples to essentially one neutrino species, right? I mean, you can at those early times, if you just erase the masses, right? I mean, it couples to one degree of freedom. So the weak interactions, therefore, I mean, when you have, beta decays or something like that, you'd be populating one neutrino species. Right?
No, but the W couples to all of them. There's an interaction between every charged lepton and every neutrino mass eigenstate, unless there are zeros in the neutrino mixing matrix. So
you can't be saying that the mixing parameter can be arbitrarily small.
No, it can't be arbitrarily small. But given that in order to explain the terrestrial experiments we are discussing here, the mixing angles still have to be, well, not terribly small. I mean, here we have the effective mixing angle, maybe order 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 2. So this means that the mixing matrix elements here still have to be of order maybe 10 to the minus 1 or so.
All right, so I got it. So if you get one and the same linear combination in beta decays, there are additional sort of weak interactions mm-hmm. that distinguish between these components in this linear combination. And they will thermalize the spots. Mm-hmm. So the statement is that it's not going to be psi squared proportional
No, unless you manage to make theta very, very small, or unless there are other effects. For example, I don't know precisely. In the early universe, you have a hot plasma. So the relevant mass eigenstates are effective mass eigenstates in matter. So the mixing is modified by the presence of matter. There is some effect of the Hubble expansion. So one might have to work this out carefully to see what it does. But naively, I would expect them to be all thermally populated.
The model of building needs an equal number of quarks and leptons to get a normally free theory. I know these are steron neutrinos, but still.
To anomalies, nothing, because the only interaction we assume for the steron neutrinos is a Yukawa coupling. So they only contribute to the neutrino mass trends. They don't have any standard model gauge interactions, so the model would still be perfectly consistent.
I don't like that. It sounds contrived.
You can of course argue that. Just putting in those extra states makes the model more ugly. That's certainly a valid point of view.
Yes, indeed.
Let me just flash my conclusions. Very briefly, is there a possibility that there is a common explanation for Minos and the short baseline results? And since you know what the question mark between the title means, I'm not going to tell you more about this. And go direct. So I'm just. It's very tough, and it would require many new ingredients. So there, these two anomalies are happening in different channels at different scales. So there is no obvious common explanation to them. So just to conclude, let me just say, in my opinion, there's an accumulation of interesting but unfortunately not particularly significant anomalies in neutrino physics. So we'd all like much better to have 1.5 sigma effect rather than 5.2 sigma effects. But still, I think there's a number of interesting anomalies that are certainly worth thinking about. And apart from that, we just have to wait for what the experiments are going to tell us in the future. Thanks.
So does one particularly appeal to you of what you talked about, and do you have a reason why?
The ones that I find most interesting is LSND because it's the most long-standing one and because it's the most statistically significant one. Another one I like is the reactor neutrino anomaly, mainly because they have done this cross-check where they actually show that there is something wrong with the old method of extracting the reactor antineutrino spectrum. However, of course, one cannot exclude that there is a third effect, which they might have overlooked, that compensates this again. So maybe the old method was wrong, but maybe it might have made two mistakes at the same time that canceled each other.
It's a complicated calculation, right? So these other groups, it's not been checked yet, right? The same method.
It has not been checked yet, no. But I know that there are several people and collaborations that are trying to do that right now.
How long do I have to live to get more data to see all this go away?
The good news is that this is all things that can be tested in the relatively near future. So we won't have to wait for a linear collider or anything. The Minos anomaly, we might already learn something about it later this year when Minos presents results with more data in antineutrino mode. At that time, maybe we will see the effect going away to below 2 sigma, or we will see the effect going up to 3 sigma. And after that, once the NOVA experiment is up and running, they have a larger detector, a more intense beam, they can also check this with a much higher precision. As for those short baseline anomalies, there was a recent workshop at Fermilab about all those short baseline neutrino physics, and I was really astonished to see how many different experimental proposals there are on the market to do tests of this in all kinds of different ways. So I'm hopeful that if at least one of those experiments is going to happen, we might learn something definitive also about this short baseline stuff within the next few years, maybe next 10 years.
10 years. Oh, dear.
There are experiments. There are experiments that can be done on a relatively short scale. For example, the microboon detector, which is now being built, which is basically some kind of a near detector to miniboon, might already help them understand their backgrounds. So microboon might already help them to resolve this issue. And there are then more ambitious proposals that would take a longer time to be realized. But they, of course, they have a higher sensitivity, so might be able to make more definitive statements.
The problem is the theorist is the...
Sorry?
I was thinking of writing a paper about CBT violation based on this data and arguing with Greenberg, okay? Mm-hmm. But then, if you think to yourself, well, it could all go away. Okay? I just like publishing another paper. I've published a lot of papers. So we're in a curious situation.
Battles carefully. CBT
violation. He's a skeptic.
Okay, that's maybe. Thank you, Joachim, again.
Okay. Thank you.